Hello, welcome to another episode of Firm Discussions. Today I'm joined by Michael Fritzell of Asian Century Stocks, and we're going to be talking about L'Occitane International. So before we, hope I'm pronouncing L'Occitane right. Is that pretty close, Michael?
I think that's okay. It's a global brand now, but if you want to pronounce it in French, maybe it's L'Occitane, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah, so before we get on to discuss L'Occitane, could you tell listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. My name is Michael Fritzell. I run a Substack called Asian Century Stocks. Been doing that for 2.5 years now, full time. Used to work as a analyst and a portfolio manager on the buy side for quite a few years, over 10 years. And before that, I was in investment banking. Basically, I've been focusing as a generalist on Asian equities for most of my career. And I've been here in Asia for about 14 years to this point, and about 10 years in Singapore, where I'm based now. And I'm my Substack, by the way, is also a generalist Substack. So I focus on anything that where I see value across the region. And I try to stick to the major markets like Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, and so on. But sometimes also these smaller markets like Philippines, Indonesia. So that's a short introduction. I'm Swedish, by the way. I was born in Sweden. I was born in Switzerland, grew up in Sweden. But I spent most of my life outside of Sweden, so I consider myself more of an international citizen. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, and I guess that will play in nicely with the company we're discussing today, given that origin for yourself as well. Yeah, maybe we can just start with our discussion of L'Occitane to just get an overview of the company, sort of what it does, where it operates, for anybody that hasn't heard of it before.
Sure. So L'Occitane, it's a skincare brand. They produce skincare products primarily, but also a few other types of personal care products, including shampoos and a variety of other products that are kind of related. And they have quite a few stores. You probably see them in most major cities worldwide. About 1,400 stores owned by themselves, and another 1,400 stores owned by distributors. So it's a major brand, L'Occitane. Specifically, the major brand in the portfolio is called L'Occitane en Provence, and that comes from the region of Provence, where the company was formed in the 1970s, and by a man called Olivier Bosson, and he created the company, but he did not internationalize it. It was mostly a French brand in the 70s and 80s, and then in 1994, there was an Austrian businessman called Reinhold Geiger, who continues to have control of the company, who has expanded it across the world, and it's become kind of a phenomenon. At least in the 2000s, I think that was when these organic products really became popular, and they rode that wave. And these days, it's not as fast growing anymore, but still a really high quality product. They're charging high prices. It's seen as a luxury brand. It's just that the Yeah, it's. I think consumers would see it as a very high quality and significant brand with a great consumer mind share, but the share price has, severely underperformed. And I can talk to you a little bit more about that if you want.
So yeah, you say it's not that fast growing, but there are they have we'll talk a little bit about acquisition later on, but they do have another couple of brands in their stable that perhaps do have higher growth rates. I'm thinking sort of Elemis and Sol de Janeiro. So yeah, are those am I right in saying those are grow still have a decent amount of growth, perhaps over and above the main brand?
Absolutely, and I think that's what makes this situation so interesting. That it's a brand within an inflection point, and one key reason for this inflection point is in 2018 they had a revised strategy where they focused more on decentralization, and I suppose also more on monetization, making sure that they're profitable. Including, for example, by tightening up the costs and being more disciplined with regards to acquisitions. And exactly whether that restructuring and change in strategy actually helped them acquire these brands at good prices. I'm not sure. They've had issues in the past with the acquisitions, causing the ROE to go from very high levels, as I think it should. You know, the ROE should be high for a company like this with decent pricing power. But now it's come down to about 8% last fiscal year. So that's clearly weak. But like you mentioned, LMA's 2019, that acquisition is performing really, I mean, quite well. It's also a cosmetics brand sold primarily to spas and salons and so on. Primarily in Europe, they're going to expand out to Asia. So that's a reasonably successful acquisition, I think. Another more important acquisition is Sol de Janeiro, which is primarily selling in the United States. It's a skincare brand focusing on products that are sold to consumers using them outdoors. I think primarily outdoors. Their most famous product is called Bum Bum Cream. People put them on their bums to tighten the skin. Right. And perhaps make it look nicer in the sun. that's what it is. It's almost for me as a male, it's hard to understand the attractiveness of this product, but I can see on every indicator that it's performing extremely well. Just look at the search queries on Google. It's absolutely they're exploding. And in fact, today, you know, speaking about search queries, we are now seeing greater search queries for Sol de Janeiro than the main brand of L'Occitane, which shows you that there is immense value in this product, which was acquired by LVMH 2 years ago. And now it's going to ramp up. You know, it has been ramping up in the last year. It's going to continue ramping up in the next year or two. And, you know, we're just going to have to see how this plays out. But for now, every indicator is showing incredible success for this brand, Sol de Janeiro.
Excellent. And are there sort of differences in margins and things like that across these different brands? Are some of them higher margin than others?
Yeah, I think the main L'Occitane en Provence brand, I think they had margins in the mid-teens, somewhere like that. Perhaps a little bit lower recently. And the Sol de Janeiro brand is already making 20% margins. But you should be seeing a lot more as operating leverage kicks in the next few years. So God knows. I mean, they're talking about, I think, a target of 16% group-wide operating margin. That's the 2026 fiscal year target. So that tells you that these two brands are at the top, I would say. I mean, these are the brands that are performing. And then they'll have a number of other brands which they've bought and have not performed as well, which they're either trying to shut down or divest. But in any case, I feel like the pressure on the margins is, if anything, it's on the upside because of Sol de Janeiro. And, you know, how high can it go? Perhaps 25 or 30% at some point. So those incremental margins are, you know, are just really contributing to the group by margin, I think, in the next 2 years.
And I did notice when I looked at their recent annual report that their gross margins are pretty phenomenal. They're sort of 80%, aren't they? And then there is quite a lot going on in the operation. So do you know, like, specifically where a lot of that's going? Is that marketing expenses and things like that that has to be maintained constantly, or what is that ending up?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure if is that the right strategy necessarily to keep prices high. And also, I do think they have inventory and they do have stores, basically, that are not as busy as they should be. The foot traffic is probably not as high as many competitors.
So you think if they drop the prices, they'd actually increase the operating margin?
I'm not sure. I mean, companies try with they have different strategies. And this has worked reasonably well for them. But I do think that the products are quite pricey, and I don't see prices going up any further. That's coming from me as a person who doesn't quite know the market. But I bought products from them a few weeks ago when doing research, and I was shocked at how expensive it was. $30 for shampoo and prices like that.
Okay,
I think that explains the high gross margins.
I guess it depends how they want to position themselves, isn't it? Because if they really are trying to position themselves as a luxury brand, then you have to have it. Whereas if they're wanting to just be more premium, then you can have the slightly lower prices, can't you? But
that's right. I mean, it does require a lot of brand building if you want to maintain such high prices. Companies like Hermes are charging incredible prices and also have high margins. But the question is, do customers buy into the story enough to pay these prices? I'm not sure. I do think there are more alternatives these days compared to 15 years ago. I just walked around in Singapore, walked around a few similar stores, and for me, they look quite similar, these products. If you go to Bath and Body Works or Lush or anything else, I don't really see why you want to pay a huge premium. But I'd also know that for sure skincare brands, they have really loyal customers, and I think most of L'Occitane's or Provence's customers, they're a little bit older and presumably have decent purchasing power. So yeah, if you like a product, if you like this, you know, hand cream or whatever, you will probably continue buying it, even if it goes up a few dollars in price.
So perhaps shifting gear a little bit, I did want to just ask, given that they're headquartered in Luxembourg/Switzerland, from what I understand, do you know why they chose to list in Hong Kong? What's the history there? And do you think that where they're currently listed has had an impact on the share price, maybe for accessibility of shareholders and so on?
Well, the backstory is this: in 2007 they had a leveraged buyout with the controlling shareholder Reinhold Geiger, and it became a leveraged entity. And 2010 they decided to make use of the high valuations in Hong Kong at the time. This was in the midst of the BRICS bubble, when Chinese equities were hot and there were flows into this region. So at that time, they got a valuation that was at a P premium of about 13% higher than L'Oreal. So their valuation was higher than L'Oreal's even at that time, you know, when European shares were hated. I suppose this was a little bit before the Eurozone crisis, but in any case, the valuation was very high at the time, and they managed to raise over 700, I think, million US dollars. So that was impressive move from their point of view, being able to crystallize value that way.
Definitely quite presumably rational at the time, yeah.
It was rational, and they also, presumably, I do think they had debt at the time, so it was the rational thing to do. But today, we're in a completely opposite situation where European luxury stocks are quite sought after. And I don't recall exactly where L'Oreal trades, but it's probably high 20s, if I'm not mistaken, at least twice the P multiple. And L'Occitane is listed in Hong Kong, but it's not a Hong Kong business. Their exposure to the Asian region is very small. So it's kind of a baby out with the bathwater situation. It shouldn't be sold down, rationally speaking, but it has been. And I think most of that is due to the fact that it's in Hong Kong.
And has there been any mention at any point of like a listing somewhere else to try and close this gap? Has they mentioned anything along those lines?
Rumors, yes. Rumors has it that they want to relist in Europe. But the question is, how are they going to do that? Are they going to privatize the company, as has been rumored and also even openly talked about, at a perhaps a low valuation, and then relist it? In that case, of course, the economics of the transaction will flow to the parent and not to minority shareholders. So we'll see. You know, we'll see how much minority shareholder can and will benefit from any relisting in Europe, which, frankly, I do think it belongs in Europe. I think Europeans understand the business much, much better than people in Hong Kong. You have, you know, you have local Chinese brokerage houses covering the stock, and of course, very talented. But it's just, I don't think it will be taken as seriously as perhaps analysts in London or Paris.
And you just mentioned there about the sort of parent group. So how much, what percentage of the actual company is publicly listed, and how much is sort of is held by the parent?
The parent owns about 73%, and okay. it's a parent that's it's not focused on much on operations, but they have been in the past. At least one transaction was acquired by one company was acquired by the parent first, and then injected into the Hong Kong list co, which is frankly not the way you would like, you know, acquisitions or to occur. And then the parent company itself is controlled by this Austrian businessman that I mentioned, Reinhold Geiger. And he owns like 59% of that parent company. And there are also another, the CEO called Andre Hoffman, also owns a big stake in the parent company. So frankly, that is not a clean corporate structure. And it puts minority shareholders in the list co in a disadvantaged position, potentially. But we'll just have to see, you know. I do think that Hong Kong, it is probably not that easy to acquire assets on the cheap in Hong Kong. So, yeah, we'll just have to see. Maybe it's now worth mentioning the acquisition, proposed acquisition.
Yeah, that would be a good timing, I think, yeah.
So, I wrote this partly inspired by a VIC post, and when I did research myself, I felt that, you know, this was spot on, like they're really onto something. But in that VIC post, they mentioned a potential acquisition, and at that time it was just a rumor. But I wrote about the stock anyway, and in my presentation I didn't mention any potential acquisition at all. But 2 days after my publishing, there was some kind of statement on the Hong Kong Exchange website where they clarified that they were under negotiation between the parent company and the list co to acquire the list co. And they also mentioned that they would put the floor at $26 per share, that any offer would be above $26. And, you know, it sounded like they were really planning to acquire the business. And it seems like there was some kind of leakage. Rumor came out that a transaction was taking place. And I'm not sure why information leaked, but anyway, it did. And in the end, it was canceled. I'm not sure if it was last week or the week before, but the transaction has been canceled. And there's been no information given as to why they canceled the acquisition. Because I do think that they still have this plan of listing the business in Europe. But apparently the rumor is that they couldn't agree on the price. The sellers, including a European large shareholder, wanted perhaps something like $35 per share. And the parent didn't want to pay more than maybe it's like 26. So there was a bid-ask spread there. They just couldn't really, they didn't want to meet in the middle. Which is unfortunate. Frankly, I expected the transaction to go through, but it hasn't. That said, though, the transaction was canceled or aborted, the share price fell to like $20 per share or a little bit more, and it's been rebounded strongly. And I think many people, including myself, they see that this is not just about buying, you know, a stagnant cash flow stream, but they also have catalysts of their own. I mean, there are products that are doing extremely well, including Sol de Janeiro. So personally, I'm a little bit shocked that the parent couldn't reach an agreement, because the longer they wait, as far as I can tell, the longer they wait, the more they will have to pay up. Because if Sol de Janeiro grows at 80% per year, or whatever it might be for the next fiscal year, you know, eventually the share price is you know, I mean, the P/E ratio is not going to stay at 14 or 15, whatever it is now.
As Sol de Janeiro starts becoming a larger and larger part of the company, yeah, it's going to be hard to miss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I wonder if perhaps, perhaps they have shifted strategy then to doing a separate listing and actually keeping, you know, keeping it, not taking it private in the interim, if you see what I mean. Maybe they have shift, maybe they've changed their mind on that. Just a speculation, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how much could they get from a listing in Europe? I'm not sure. I mean, in the past, they've traded maybe like 22 times PE. The peer group trades more than that. But that would be a price of 35, maybe. So okay. Perhaps the differential, it was just not large enough. But I still think, I still think it's weird that the economics cannot be shared with minority shareholders and the parent. There's got to be some price at which the market clears, you know?
Yeah. And so, presumably, I mean, they could also, if they wanted, they have the, even if they decrease the amount they make from buying their 30% or whatever, they need to get the shares that are listed publicly and taking them back. If they were to instead, alternatively, they could give up a little bit more value potentially to get a larger, to get some extra returns in, if they'd relisted in Europe or something, another option. But
yeah, I mean, there is a risk here, and I want to point that out. The in the last earnings call, last earnings announcement, they announced that they would increase marketing spend on the main L'Occitane en Provence brand, which doesn't make any sense because it's no growth brand. So this increase in marketing spend is a little bit worrying because it could mean that they're spending unnecessarily. Perhaps they don't want earnings to go up in the short term.
Ah, okay.
You know, as long as they continue to have this plan of acquiring the Lisco. I mean, that is what I'm worried about as a shareholder. You know, maybe perhaps it's too cynical, but that's the only thing to me that I worry about, because the business itself, growth wise, is doing really well.
Trying to hide the outperformance of the Sol de Janeiro brand and so on with a lower performance on paper from the other brands.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could just go into a little bit more detail around some of the recent acquisitions they have done. So just like how the deals were structured, maybe a little bit, or what sort of percentage of the, I mean, how much have they added to the company, if you see what I mean? How much of the brand, how much of the overall company now consists of the original brand versus some of the newer brands they've added to their stable? I think I saw something about like Elemis making up, is it a quarter of the overall revenue now or something along those lines?
The L'Occitane en Provence brand is about 2/3 of revenues now.
Okay.
And Sol de Janeiro is about 12% and Elemis 12% too. The other brands are combined 9%. So very small. And they're also not contributing to profits that much. There's been no breakdown as far as I've seen about Elemis profitability.
Okay.
But I do think that they should definitely be profitable given that the store count is lower and they're selling to third parties to a large extent, more of a wholesaler than a retailer, although they also have stores. That is the breakdown. And the acquisitions in the past, it's been a mixed bag. And I mentioned the return on equity, and it's been coming down over time because of all these acquisitions that, frankly, have not been made at particularly good prices. Elemis was done at a 23 times EBITDA.
Yeah,
I mean, that sounds a lot to me. Sol de Janeiro was bought at 21 times EBITDA, but with the explosive growth that they've shown, perhaps that's okay. I mean, certainly it has been okay. That's been an amazing acquisition. But the, you know, a few of the other brands, they bought Lime Life by Alcona for 128 million. I think still loss making. So you know, we can talk about multiples, but the key point is this: the ROE is weak. And I think that's not due to the main business. It's primarily due to acquisitions.
All the goodwill they've been putting on the balance sheet.
Yes, a lot of goodwill. And also, another issue is the fact that, you know, they've been able to buy back their own shares. So why haven't they? I mean, they could buy back shares much cheaper.
Mm, yeah, good point.
So let me look at the EBITDA right now for the company. Well, I don't have the number here, but it's certainly below 10 times. So why should you buy fairly slow growing brand at over 20 times? I'm not sure.
Interesting. Yeah. So I mean, maybe we could just branch into capital allocation more generally then. So you said they haven't really been exploring things like buybacks. Have they? What other kind of other than merger and acquisitions? And you were mentioning a bit about, I guess, some internal spend, increased marketing and what have you. How have they been generally allocating capital?
Very conservatively. So they've been paying out about 30-40% in dividends, and the rest has basically been used for acquisitions. That's been their strategy.
Right, okay.
Which is not based on value. There's nothing there that has to do with value. It has to do with, we will invest anything that we have for growth. So okay. I do think that there's something missing here in terms of shareholder orientation. And yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's perhaps a little bit of... speaks to the personality perhaps of the management of being a bit more empire building than really trying to maximize value to shareholders, which is unfortunate. But
I gotta say I've met a lot of companies in the past decade or two, and very few of them understand the point of buybacks in Asia. It's rare for them to think rationally about these decisions. So I won't necessarily say that they're worse than the average, at least not in the Asian context. Yeah. But it leaves something to be desired. I should mention one fact though is that they've hired a new CFO called Clever. His name is Christian Matthias Clever, and he is clever. He used to work as a CFO of Breitling under CVC ownership, and I think that's a positive. He also has a great resume in other respects. He's worked for a number of large companies in senior roles. And a person like that, if you get hired by a PE firm like CVC, you understand capital allocation. That is almost guaranteed. So I do feel positive that he joined the company recently. And we'll just have to see, whether he can, what he can do in terms of maximizing shareholder value. Hopefully not the parent shareholder value, but
yeah, well,
those are the risks.
I guess the skeptical take would be that if the shareholder is that they know that the parent company really is still pulling the strings, then they might be, and they're wanting to do an acquisition at an attractive price in the future, then things like share buybacks sort of would naturally increase the price at which they'd have to pay there. So there are some risks, I guess, along that, on being very skeptical. But I just forgot to ask, with the some of the prior acquisitions they've made, have any of them been written down at all? Has there been any history of that for the ones that have perhaps underperformed?
Yeah, we've seen write-downs, I think. I don't recall exactly which fiscal year, but we've seen some write-downs, and that's been a recurring issue, I think, in the past, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
So these costs, I mean, these write-downs, ideally, we should take them into account when we calculate multiples. But if you get a new CFO and capital allocation truly improves, then perhaps we can see them as one-offs.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's my view.
And hopefully, I mean, it sounds like with this stable of brands they've got now, the rational strategy going forward would be to, deploy capital alternatively into buybacks or whatever, and just try and focus on growing the current brands that they have, which it sounds like they've already got several that are high potential and are worth growing.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, if I was management, I would buy back shares up until a share price of like 35.
Okay,
that's what I would, because that's what I see as kind of intrinsic value. Personally, not a recommendation, but I would see that as maybe fair value, because that would be about maybe 22 times quite near term earnings.
Okay,
yeah.
So that, I mean, that's what you see then. Yeah, maybe that would be a good, this now's a good time to just look at that valuation more generally, so and sort of the upside you're seeing in an investment right now. So you've kind of, in your mind, the fair value, so your sort of margin of safety is between the current to sort of roughly 20 times dollars to sort of 35. That's sort of your initial upside, and then I think if they weren't acquired or something like that, there's then going to be growth beyond there. Maybe just expand on that a little bit.
It takes into account the growth of Sol de Janeiro, and how big it can be, it's a little unclear. But, well, I suppose we can look at it this way. They targeted 3 billion euros in revenues and 0.16% in operating margin. So that's almost a half a billion euros in operating profits. And I think the EV now is below 5, so it's going to be below 10 times EV to EBIT, which is very low in this industry. Mm. So I don't know exactly. I think this target is reasonable, and if they do meet it, they could certainly get a twice as high EV to enterprise value. I think that's potentially. That's a potential. You can also make some assumptions about the growth of Sol de Janeiro. Actually, my estimates are fairly similar in that. So I'm actually looking ahead and assuming multiple on that. And right now, I think it could certainly be above 35. If you look at 2026 numbers, on my numbers here is 12 times PE, around the same share price. So 12 times PE, that could be 22 times. That would be, 90% higher. So 24 Hong Kong dollars times 1.9. I don't even know what that is. But it's high 30s for sure.
Yeah.
I want to say this as well. If we invest in a company that has a great product that's really doing well, I don't really know how many, let's say, Asians are going to buy this product, because it's really hard to say what is the addressable market. We just have to kind of wait. I can tell that the brand is doing well, but you're just going to have to wait and see how far they can take it. So, for example, they got Sephora. They're sold in Sephora right now in the United States, almost. That's exclusively now in the US. Only 2024. This store exclusivity will end, and then it will be released to other stores in the United States. It's going to be a huge positive. I just saw the other day at Temu, this e-commerce website, Chinese American website. The first product that shows up on the website is Bum Bum Cream. So clearly, there's a demand for the product. I think it's just a matter of meeting that demand, and it's doing really well in the US. We're going to see how well it does in Europe and Asia. Perhaps Asian will not, are not as much into beach culture. I know that's for a fact. So who knows, right? But at least what we can do is we can see this story play out. And then 2 years from now, we'll be able to say, yes, they've managed to expand this much. And then I can make a new decision. But it's hard for me to say exactly what revenues they're going to make in a few years' time. I'm just saying that I'm personally positive that L'Occitane will be way bigger in terms of revenues in 3 years' time.
Yeah, no, I think it definitely has a lot of potential from what you're saying. Is there any we've mentioned a few key management figures along the way. Is there anyone else you sort of wanted to mention you think that's important, or anything else you wanted to say about management?
I suppose one thing is the CEO, Andre Hoffman. I do think that Randall Geiger, the executive chairman, he continues to run the business as an empire, like you mentioned. But it is also worth mentioning that Andre Hoffman, he was previously in charge of his own business doing distribution of consumer products in Asia. And it was then kind of became part of L'Occitane eventually. It was 2004 it was acquired and absorbed into L'Occitane. So he has a large focus on Asia. And that means that they will put a focus on bringing LMS and bringing Solar Conator to Asia, which is a fairly large market. So I wouldn't necessarily, my point here is that I wouldn't assume that the growth in Solar Conator will be limited to the US or LMS to Europe. I think they have additional avenues for growth here in Asia too.
Good stuff. So yeah, we've mentioned a few risks along the way of different things. A lot of it is perhaps founded in just being skeptical. But do you see there being any sort of potentially that what we've largely discussed has been things that perhaps wouldn't give shareholders the best deal on the upside from here? We wouldn't capture all of potential upside. But is there anything you could see that really presents some downside for shareholders from here, from the current price?
Yes, excessive marketing spend or poor control of costs. I do think the main L'Occitane en Provence brand, it's not doing that well. I think it's a little bit of a stagnant business, perhaps mid-single digits growth, which is fine compared to, I think, L'Oréal and Beiersdorf and these other companies, other competitors. But it's not growing that fast. I do think they're going to benefit from the recovery in China from the zero COVID policy last year. We saw outbreaks, you know, throughout the first quarter up into the second quarter. So that recovery is going to continue. But longer term, L'Occitane, it's hard to say whether it's going to be as vibrant, you know, as strong of a brand in 3 years' time. So that's something I would worry about. And there's been some employees talking about how they're pushing products into the wholesale channel. And if you do that, there's a risk of discounts. There's a risk that the brand will be tarnished if you do that too much. That's why these major luxury brands, they like to have control over the distribution so that they can maintain prices and this perception that it's an aspirational brand. And if it's true that L'Occitane is pushing too much product into the wholesale channels, then perhaps you could see some, you know, customers not regarding the brand as particularly luxurious anymore.
Okay,
I suppose. And then the big risk, of course, is an acquisition. We have seen a number of acquisitions in the past. This, you know, Solar Conator panned out really well, but I do think, on average, M&A does not add value to minority shareholders. So I'm worried that they will buy, you know, another skincare brand at a too high valuation.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so I think that's pretty much everything I could think of around the company. I mean, is there anything else do you think we should mention about the L'Occitane or just the investment thesis in general?
No, I think this is a fairly simple story. You have L'Occitane, it's a fairly stable brand. It's benefiting from the end of zero COVID policy in China. And then on top of that, you have this explosive growth in Sol de Janeiro, the Bum Bum Cream, which, you know, I've watched countless videos on YouTube trying to understand it. And while I don't understand why you use it, frankly, I do see that there is enthusiasm. People talking about the how you know how clean of a product it is in terms of their ingredients. They talk about how their skin looks better after it, after using it. So there is something there in terms of growth. And personally, I'm going to just wait and see how this pans out in the next few years. And just hoping that management doesn't screw it up.
Yeah, they do seem to be the weakest link in it, management, unfortunately. But well, thanks. I think we've given a good coverage there. Do you want to give listeners or let listeners know where they can go find out about yourself, your newsletter, hand off all to that kind of stuff?
Sure. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. X.com. And my handle is Mike Fritzell, Mike Fritzell, Fritzell. And I also have my Substack, which is my full-time job. And I write at AsianCenturyStocks.com. So I do 20-plus deep dive reports every year, together with videos and other types of discussion on the Substack for paid subscribers. I also have free content for those who don't want to pay. So, yeah, check it out.
You do have quite a unique style of doing things with PowerPoint presentations, which is a good. It's quite nice. It's good for flicking through. It's good, certainly faster, I would say, to get through and get the real thesis quickly for these things. Yeah, so I quite like it.
I'm hanging in there with the PowerPoints. Maybe I look young, but I'm almost 40 years old. You know, PowerPoint to me is the way to do things. But yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Michael, for coming on and pitching the stock. And thanks everyone for listening. And we'll see you in the next episode.